All the stories today, well, most of them anyway, seem to begin at the Supreme Court, and that includes ours. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of KUOW in Seattle, Washington, today I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you along, everybody. So, Justice Kennedy. Yes, but not on the day of, anyway, part of our brief, so we are going to stay in our lane, which today, as it happens, also begins at the Supreme Court. The big decision this morning was Janus v. AFSCME, as we talked about the other day, whether public sector employees, teachers and cops and city workers who don't belong to a public sector union like AFSCME can be forced to pay collective bargaining fees to those unions. There are all kinds of layers to the story. Obviously, we are going to pick two of them, the first of which is this. One of the things labor organizes for is to protect and increase wages. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank gets us going with what today's ruling might mean for public sector worker pay.
Today's ruling basically makes every state a right-to-work state when it comes to government workers. Right-to-work laws prevent unions from compelling employees to join or pay fees. So if you want to know what the ruling means for wages, UC Berkeley economist Sylvia Allegretto says just look around.
We've had some states that have gone right to work, such as Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan. And what we saw there is slight decreases in wages for union workers.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, people in states that allow workers to opt out of unions make about $6,000 less than workers in other states. Unions can help drive up wages for non-union workers, too.
Your bargaining power depends on the bargaining power of the entire labor movement.
Kate Bronfenbrenner is a labor researcher at Cornell.
When workers organize and bargain good contracts, they help all workers.
Harvard labor economist Henry Farber says that's what the evidence shows when it comes to private sector unions, at least.
Where the threat of unionization is high, non-union employers tend to treat their workers better. There's a lot of evidence out there that unions can have these kinds of spillovers.
The High Court's decision that weakens public sector unions comes as wages for U.S. workers are picking up a bit after more than a decade of basically non-existent growth. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
There is kind of a sizable logistical chunk of today's ruling that does bear mention, and it's this. The precedent that the court overturned today, it's a case called Abood v. Detroit Board of Education, was decided 41 years ago. And in the years since, laws and systems and collectively bargained contracts have been set up to comply with it, which means that now there is going to be a whole lot of scrambling going on. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
So how many workers might be affected by overturning the established precedent allowing public sector unions to collect fees from non-union members? Analyst Amy Howe at SCOTUS blog says it's right there in Justice Elena Kagan's dissenting opinion.
Thousands of contracts affecting millions of people across the country. Those provisions are now invalid.
Christine Owens at the National Employment Law Project says,
in places where agency fee is the law, they will basically have to rewrite the laws and revise contracts, revise agency agreements.
Losing those agency fees will be a big financial hit for many public sector unions, but not all. Harold Schaitberger is head of the International Association of Firefighters, representing 312,000 workers. He says in many of its contracts, the union doesn't even collect agency fees. He says most firefighters voluntarily join the union and pay full dues, so unions now have to convince workers
what the value of their union is to them and the reason they should want to belong, not a reason that they have to belong.
Meanwhile, unions have tried to get ahead of today's adverse decision for labor by pushing for state laws to help them hold on to members and keep them paying dues. In California, for instance, unions get to make a presentation to new employees touting the benefits of union membership, and state agencies can't try to dissuade employees from joining. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was fine till it wasn't. Tech was the big loser. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. does kind of feel like we got a week's worth of news for you today, so this one might have slipped by you. But this morning, the White House announced it's not going to be imposing additional investment restrictions on China. For now, what it's going to do instead is back a plan working its way through Congress that's going to reform something called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS, as it's known. Doesn't come up much in casual conversation, that committee, even in Washington, really. But with all the economic back and forth with China right now, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports that CFIUS is getting a whole lot more attention.
The legislation President Trump is backing would give the committee more teeth. Right now, companies voluntarily file notice with CFIUS. Amy Jocelyn is with law firm Cooley LLP and helps companies navigate the process.
To either confirm that any national security issues are either mitigated or that they take steps to ensure that those concerns are resolved.
The House and Senate have different versions of legislation to update this process, but generally, says Jocelyn,
it will formalize the committee's focus on certain technology sectors, certain sectors that they've termed as emerging and foundational technologies.
That could mean certain companies in the tech sector would be required to file notice. Nova Daily at law firm Wiley Ryan used to run the CFIUS process at the Department of Treasury. He says some companies will have to change how they do business.
In terms of who they choose to be an investor and whether that means that they'll have to seek and go through an additional CFIUS review.
Especially if that investor comes from China. James Lewis is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The goal here is to catch China. The way the rules are written, it will catch other countries that we want to have partnerships with.
Now Congress and the administration have to come to an agreement on how to stop China from investing in sensitive industries like high tech and aerospace without blocking other investment American companies want. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We're going to do a quick update now on the Disney versus Comcast in pursuit of 21st Century Fox saga that's been in the news of late. There's a lot at stake in this story for the future of what we watch and how we watch it. Hello, streaming. But since even a story about Mickey Mouse and The Simpsons can feel a little bit dry when it comes with a subtext of corporate mergers and acquisitions, we are going to bring you today's developments by way of a new every now and then series we are going to debut right this very minute. It's called Incremental Changes. Get it? So many stories these days are incremental changes. To catch up, last week, Disney offered Fox shareholders more money than Comcast had, a lot more. This morning, the Wall Street Journal reported Comcast was hunting around for some extra cash, trying to sweeten its offer. Day late and several billion dollars short might be the phrase here, because also this morning, the Justice Department gave its seal of approval with a couple of conditions for the Disney 21st Century Fox deal to go ahead. Still pending, of course, regulatory approvals from some key overseas markets. No, global capitalism is not a zero-sum game. There can be winners and then more winners, but there can be losers as well. And when you start talking Brexit, London, we are looking at you. As the European Union meets later this week to talk, among other things, Britain leaving, Ireland is paying close attention, because not only are Paris and Frankfurt angling to pick up what banking business London might lose, so too is Dublin, which is doubly curious, because Ireland's bankers did the country no favors during the financial crisis. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on that one.
In a corner of a shopping mall in the centre of Dublin, a grim reminder of Ireland's tragic past.
This exhibition tells the story of the greatest catastrophe in Irish history.
Gerard McCarthy curated this powerful collection of photographs depicting the effects of the Great Famine of the mid-19th century. Ireland's financial crisis a decade ago pales in comparison, but McCarthy says for him the financial crisis has definitely left a bitter taste.
You know, when the banks failed, that debt was put on the heads of every single Irish person, so we'll be paying back that for years to come.
You're not happy about that?
I'm not overly happy about that, no. Surprise, surprise.
No surprise that bankers and financiers are not popular here. Wildly excessive bank lending fueled the real estate boom that led to the crash that bankrupted the country and cost 250,000 people their jobs. Now, ironically, it's the finance industry that could benefit most from the next major threat to the Irish economy, Brexit. Ken Owens is with consulting firm PwC.
In the context of something that is going to be damaging to the overall economy, financial services is one area where we actually can see some upside.
After Brexit, London-based financial firms may not have the same access to the European market. So why not shift operations to Ireland? That's the message the country's Industrial Development Authority, or IDA, has been pumping out.
We are the one English-speaking country in the Eurozone. We are 100% committed to the EU.
More than 100 global financial companies are talking to the IDA, and a handful have already committed to Dublin, says the authority's Kieran Donoghue.
Bank of America Merrill Lynch, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, and several other firms have said that they're going to either establish a new presence in Dublin or expand their existing office as a response to Brexit.
And here's one reason why.
Yes, what's going on? Any liquid credit bank, please?
Many of the voices you hear over the intercoms on the dealing desks in Dublin have a Cockney accent. Ireland's financial centre is connected umbilically with London, often acting as a back office for its British counterpart. The thinking is switching between the two shouldn't be too tricky. Dublin's financial sector currently employs some 40,000 people. Donoghue expects a big boost from Brexit.
Employment within, say, 5 years of Brexit will certainly be in excess of 50,000.
That's another 10,000 jobs.
Yes, yes.
More's the pity, say some Dubliners. Sawley McCaughey of the relief charity Christian Aid blames Ireland's financial sector for what he calls tax avoidance on a massive scale by multinationals that operate in the developing world, depriving poor countries, he believes, of much-needed revenue. He deplores the thought that thousands more hard-nosed financial workers could be heading into Dublin after Brexit.
With a whole new swathe of very savvy international financial companies relocating to Ireland, I would have significant concerns about the kind of financial shenanigans that have served them very well in London and other places.
Others fear another boom and bust, but Dublin say the optimist is different and chastened, and it lacks skyscrapers, which some have half seriously linked to the hubris that precedes a crash. Where I'm standing in this curiously low-rise financial district, I can't see anything over 10 stories high. Mind you, that didn't save this city from that monumental crash a decade ago. In Dublin, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They haven't turned that capability on yet because they're afraid people will consider that sort of stalking.
Yeah, what the airline knew when you flew. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrial's off 165 today, 0.6%, closed at 24,117. NASDAQ off 116. That is 1.5% on that particular index. 74.45. The S&P 500 gave back 23 points, about 0.8%, 26.99. With rising international trade tensions, word today that new orders for U.S. durable goods, stuff like toasters and home appliances and automobiles, things designed to last 3 years or more, they fell 0.6% in May. Driving over to the car lot, American automaker Ford slowed down 0.8% today. General Motors sputtered about 1.5%. Japanese auto manufacturer Toyota lost about 0.5%. The National Association of Realtors says pending home sales fell 0.5% in May, so we'll look at financial institutions that make money when buyers buy. Quicken Loans gave back about 0.1% today. Bank of America sagged 1%. JP Morgan Chase slipped 1.5%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.82%. That's what you call a flight to safety. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace delivers independent public service journalism that matters. You can help us do it by becoming a Marketplace investor today. And right now, your donation in any amount could unlock a $25,000 challenge from Candida if we meet our fiscal year goal of 6,000 donors by June the 30th. So please contribute today at marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. As I said about lining up this next item, there is some degree of poetry in the fact that I'm in Seattle today, a city that's having some fairly well-publicized angst with its growing wealth and wealth disparity as the overall economy around here, well, prospers might be too mild, boom probably works. What is happening here in Seattle is happening in a lot of cities in this country. New money moving in, leaving those with less money out. Kevin Baker has a very long essay in the new issue of Harper's Magazine about exactly that happening in the biggest city in the country. It's titled The Death of a Once Great City. Kevin Baker, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
New York has become unremarkable, you say, even boring, which is, I don't think, how a lot of people think about New York City.
And I think this is the first time, really, that has happened in its modern history. It's still an exciting city, but it is a city that is having the life just sucked out of it by this sort of plague of wealth that has now enveloped us.
Yeah, you call it a crisis of affluence, the world's biggest gated community. Explain a little bit what you mean.
That's what we seem to be headed to. We really have this huge disparity created by these billionaires pouring in from all over the world. And our former mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, at one point, frankly, welcomed them.
Well, more people like him. I mean, he's a billionaire. We got to say that, right?
You know, I guess everybody likes to live with their own, but... you know, the problem is these aren't your grandfather's billionaires. These people are often here for 2 weeks a year. You know, the New Yorker found that this huge swath of territory, Park Avenue to 5th, 49th to 70th, one in every three apartments is empty for at least 10 months a year. These are people who are just kind of using the city the way kings used to use a forest as their personal preserve.
We should be clear here, and you are in your piece. You're not eager to go back to the New York City of the late 70s and early 80s, right?
Right.
When it was not a nice place.
I tried to make that clear, and yeah, I've been in New York City since 1976. There were a lot of exciting things about it. There were, of course, a lot of completely dysfunctional things about it. But what amazes me is, even with all this affluence now, how little has been done to fix most of that social dysfunction. There are more homeless in New York City now than ever before. The poverty rate is higher than it was in 1975 when the city was teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. So a lot of these things have not been fixed, even as in the aggregate, the city gets wealthier and wealthier.
So what are we losing then? If a lot of things have been fixed, right, but many social things have not, what are we missing? What are we losing? What does the city feel like now that makes it boring, as you say?
Well, we're losing a lot of the middle class. We're losing a lot of the working class. The boring parts are also that more and more of the great cultural stuff in the city that used to be pretty cheap now is more and more expensive as fees are charged for that. You know, it costs $18 to go to the Central Park Zoo today. You know, it used to be a free zoo. You just wander in there on your lunch break or something. Everything now, there's a fee to it. And it's a very hard city for people making modest incomes, and particularly people with families who have modest incomes. Very hard city for them to live in.
So here comes the put up or shut up. You ready?
Sure.
Why do you stay?
Oh, there's still a great many things I like about it. And I'm fortunate enough to live on a street that is still this wonderful little niche, this mixture of people. But it's changing, too. You go out to the street to Broadway in this very – what's now a very prosperous neighborhood in terms of personal income. And a third of the store frontage is vacant. These stores are being run out of business left and right by the LLCs that own buildings, by other New Yorkers who own co-ops and want to just kind of keep upping the rents all the time. So it's sort of becoming this vertical suburb with a kind of the equivalent of an empty mall in it. And I don't think anybody quite likes it all that much, but they don't really know how to fix it.
Kevin Baker writing in the July issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called The Death of a Once Great City. Kevin, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
True. true story from my flight up here to Seattle this morning. There I was, safely seated in my upgraded by miles, thank you very much, seat. And the flight attendant came around, as I guess they do when you get to sit in front of the plane. And she asked me by name if I'd like something to drink. I said, coffee, please, two creamers, and then realized she'd call me by name, which doesn't really happen when you're back behind the partition curtain. But, writes Scott McCartney, travel columnist for the Wall Street Journal, that's going to be changing as airlines start really using all the information they have about we, the passengers. Scott, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be back with you.
So, airlines know a lot of things about us already, but the point of this column is that they now have even more tools to know more things.
Yeah, I think they do know more about us, and they're putting it in the cabin. The handheld devices that began as point-of-sale devices, so you could buy food on board or drinks on board, they've been loaded up with new apps that have gotten more and more sophisticated with information about each passenger, from birth dates and where they live, if you want, to their flight connections, how many miles they have, what they paid for their ticket, a wealth of information now.
Does it get as granular as what I ordered on the last flight? Because pretty much every time I fly United, I have the tapas box when I'm taking that late flight from from L.A. to the East Coast, and that's what I get. Are they going to know that?
They are going to know that. Well, they know it. They haven't delivered it to flight attendants yet, but that's something that several airlines are working on. The whole idea that, you know, the cart will come down the aisle, they'll get to seat 14B, and they'll say, would you like your usual today?
So here's the thing. With great power comes great responsibility. What are they doing with this data that maybe we don't know about?
Well, they can do lots of things. They haven't yet figured out how far they can go with this. For example, JetBlue is putting little birthday cake icons on your seat on the map that flight attendants have. So if it's your birthday, now they know when your birthday is because the government requires you to give them your birth date. They make a big deal out of it. They'll give you a card signed by the crew, and it's all fun and games. United has decided that they're going to leave birthday wishes up to the discretion of flight attendants, recognizing that some people will feel that sort of an invasion of privacy. United also has the ability, interestingly, to track your last five flights. So they'll give it a score. Was it green if it was good, red if they lost your bag, things like that. The idea would be someday that they would say, Kai, we're sorry we lost your bag on the last flight. Here's a free drink. But they haven't turned that capability on yet because they're afraid people will consider that sort of stalking.
It's interesting. The producer on the other side of the glass and the engineer are nodding in the free drink in return for the lost bag. I, however, think that's creepy.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would think that's creepy, especially at a time when information that companies have about us and what they do with that is such a hot button issue.
Yeah.
You know, it really gets into Facebook and everything else. To have the airline tracking you that closely can really be off-putting.
This has to be in service of the bottom line, though, right? That's why they're doing it?
Yeah, I think so. I think the whole idea really is to personalize service in the coach cabin, particularly with the premier frequent flyers. You know, people don't get upgrades the way they used to.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of high mileage people in the coach cabin. How do you differentiate between them and the once a year flyer who paid a really cheap fare? It almost takes the class distribution that we have when we board and puts it on the airplane, where the Group 1 people are superior to the Group 12 people. And the people who have flown 6 million miles will get better coach treatment than the rest of us.
Scott McCartney, he writes the middle seat column at the Wall Street Journal. Scott, thanks a lot.
Sure. Good to be with you.
This final note on the way out today, the late Jesse Unruh, for almost 8 years, the Speaker of the California State Assembly, once said that money is the mother's milk of politics, which it is. But this is also true. These are the midterm elections of 2018, which gets me to this. Political newcomer Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, as you probably heard by now, beat 10-term incumbent Joe Crowley last night in the Democratic primary in New York's 14th congressional district. According to Politico, Crowley spent $1.1 million April through the first week of June trying to keep that seat. Ocasio-Cortez spent $128,140 winning it. Because 2018. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials off 165 today, about 0.6%. The NASDAQ down 116. That is 1.5%. S&P 500 shed 23 points, 0.8%. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. Thanks also today to the folks here at KUOW. They bought me lunch. That was nice. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back in L.A. tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.